choices yo. You can get with this or you can get with that. Or you can get with this or you can get with that. Or you can get with this or you can get with that. I think you can get with this because this is where it's at. You can get with this or you can get with that. Or you can get with this or you can get with that. Or you can get with this or you can get with that. I think you can get with this because this is kind of fat.
Where's the black sheep? Here's the black sheep. Even if we wanted to, the clock cannot be weak. Watch me swing like this. Watch it, I swing like.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bruce Fein, who is a senior advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 presidential campaign. He is a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and he helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fein is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fein.
Well, I'm excited to be on your program, Ian.
And Bruce, last the debate that just took place, the second Republican presidential campaign debate on national security, pretty much put your candidate Ron Paul and Huntsman on one side and the rest of them on the other. What's your sense, though, of this disconnect? Because Ron Paul gets rousing cheers from the audiences at these events, yet the candidates on stage seem to sort of treat him with kind of uncomfortable scorn or disdain, and the press largely ignores him. So how do you explain this disconnect between what seems to be popular support and yet the punditry seems to be against him?
To quote Dwight D. Eisenhower, the military-industrial and now an adaptation international terrorism complex. We have a empire psychology that's pervasive throughout the political leadership that conceives the United States as endowed with some special mission to police the world, to bring what the United States believe is virtue all around the planet by military force or otherwise. And there's huge amount of money and stature behind this $1.2 annual trillion spent on national security. And there really is no relationship between the spending and this national projection of military force in the United States safety. In fact, it is our presence and intermeddling abroad, whether it's propping up despots or otherwise, that creates the anger and resentment against the United States. And this utter absurdity of suggesting that it's because the Islamists hate freedom, they hate ballots in voting booths, and they hate free press and free speech is what caused to have resentment against the United States is idiotic. If you take, for instance, a typical member of Taliban in Afghanistan at present, his entire life has lived within probably a half-mile radius of his birth. Most of them are illiterate. They think the United States are the Russians still, fighting, you know, for years ago when the Soviet Union invaded in 1979. They're fighting because we're over there trying to kill them and trying to intermeddle in their affairs. And Ron Paul is the only one who can step outside this empire psychology box and call a spade a spade. He's millions for defense, not 1 cent for empire, not to make the United States less safe, but to have Americans defending us rather than Afghans or Pakistanis for some ulterior motive.
Well, Huntsman, by the way, had an exchange with Romney where Huntsman said that we just should get out of Afghanistan as quickly as possible, and there was no justification for having 100,000 troops, and they don't even cross the wire, most of them, and he would say, I think he said to bring it down to about 10, 25,000. And that, of course, was greeted by tremendous rebukes from Romney and others. But at the same time, again, as is the case with Ron Paul, the audience seemed to cheer, and I think if you do honest polling in this country, I think you'll find that most Americans support the positions of Huntsman and Ron Paul.
I agree with you, but it's the leadership that's lacking. I think that the American people acquiesce in their leaders, even though I believe that if the president, whoever it was, pulled out, there'd be no marching in the streets. I've been here again in the United States Capitol for 43 years, and these last years I've never seen a single demonstrator marching up and down Constitutional Avenue saying, we need to fight more wars. Stay in Iraq, you know, stay in Afghanistan, stay in Somalia. Not a single one. There are no demonstrations in favor of these wars, but people are easily frightened and alarmed, and they get anxious when their leaders tell them that unless we have a perimeter that's 8,000 miles away, you know, there'll be a caliphate in Washington, D.C. the next day, and there'll be bodies on the sidewalk. And that's true even when the latest so-called international terrorist plots are identified. They involve teenagers or little more than that who are half-daft, and it seems like Peter Sellers' exercises there with regard to this effort to recruit the Mexican drug cartels to kill the Saudi Arabian ambassador, and you know, with the complicity of informants working for DEA or otherwise. But I surely agree with you that the American people are not going to vote out of office anyone who stands up and says the wars are counterproductive. We need to have our troops defending United States citizens, their brothers, their sisters, husbands and wives, not others. We don't go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. We just create resentments. We squander money and we squander our own lives. But it still, it takes some leader. And what's really stunning to me is that I am convinced if the president today announced that he was removing all the troops over a phased period of time, maybe a month, to take the C-17s back to the United States, and nothing happened. There's no attack on Washington, D.C. or any other city in the United States, you know, for the year after. You know, suddenly the bluff had been called. Well, why did we need all those troops over there? It doesn't seem that they were the ones who were defending, you know, like Horatio at the bridge, the last fighting place before they would be, you know, stomping in Washington, D.C. And with regard to that 100,000 troop level, Ian, I calculated that if the troop-to-enemy ratio that we now employ in Afghanistan was used in World War II, we would have fielded an armed force of 3.5 billion people. We would have had to multiply our population by 126 and conscript everybody. That is how inflated this danger is from abroad.
So did you feel, Bruce Fine, again, a senior advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 presidential campaign, did you feel that to some extent that this latest Republican presidential candidate's debate on national security was rigged, given the sponsors by the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation? But the question is, Wolfowitz, Fred Kagan, who claims to be the architect of the surge, Daniel Pletker, and David Addington, the prince of torture, they were the elder statesmen.
Yeah, it's a rather misnomer, but I would agree with you. It's hard to find, you know, a more stacked neocon empire psychology, if you will, to call from the Yankees' murderers row, than those that you've identified. And Kurtz, it was stacked because you can confine an answer by the nature of the question. And none of the questions really went to the core of the problem. Are all of these troops making us safer? Aren't they all, aside from endangering us by creating enemies, it's simply financially prohibitive. $1.2 trillion, Ian, we spend annually on national security. That sum equals the combined defense spending of all the rest of the planet. You know, and it said that, well, you know, if we cut anything, Leon Panetta, our defense secretary, says it'll be disaster. We'll be eating out the core of our defense establishment, which is utterly and completely ridiculous. And we have 11 aircraft carriers, for instance. And is anyone worrying about we're going to be attacked on the shores with aircraft carriers from, you know, Contiki boats from Al-Qaeda? I mean, these things are ridiculous. And I say these not because there aren't real dangers from abroad. There are, like there are in domestic affairs as well. There are potential murderers, a potential terrorist like Timothy McVeigh. But you've got to be able to explain that risk is part of life. And the only way you can end with a risk-free existence is to imprison everybody and fight everybody under the sun, because at some future time they could turn against you. But we simply can't maintain civilization with the idea we can't accept even 0.001% of a risk of danger to ourselves. And I was talking to some people who were involved with the Awaki assassination in Yemen, and there was no attempt to even capture him. And those are the experts on the ground said that could have been done easily. If he obviously attempted to resist, as there is in the domestic situation, police can use deadly force to kill a fleeing felon who would create an imminent danger to others, although Al-Waqi himself had not even been indicted or accused of a single crime. But that wasn't done. And the argument was, well, we don't want to create any danger to our soldiers in fighting. We can imagine that if the standard is no danger to our soldiers, we might as well drop nukes and kill the whole civilian and military population there and walk away. You know, Carthaginian peace. And I underscore the importance of politicians, the leaders standing up and explaining to the American people, you have to take some risk. That's the nature of life, as you call it, a tragedy. But we cannot be in the business of thinking, well, somebody at some future time could do something bad, so we imprison them or kill them. That's the end of freedom and liberty, which is the reason why we have a country.
So, Bruce Fine, do you think touch on the defense budget, that this failure of this super committee and the sequestration of these automatic cuts, is any of that real? Because some people are thinking that with the president threatening to veto anything that doesn't that tries to weasel out of the sequestration, the automatic cuts, that these cuts will actually happen. When I talk to defense analysts in Washington and Pentagon watchdogs, they say, "Forget about it. Of course, it won't happen. They'll find ways to get around it."
Well, I agree with that latter observation, Ian. And remember, it was cleverly designed to have the sequestration kick in after, and I underscore after, the November 2012 elections. So after everybody is off the hot seat, you know, with regard to the budget, then they'll go cut a deal. And in my judgment, there'll be some raising of taxes, and then they'll save the defense budget. And that's where I think perhaps Grover Norquist is going to find that if they got to choose between a no-tax pledge and pacifying Lockheed and Boeing and these huge military complexes that have strategically placed factories in all these key districts, they're going to vote for the defense contractors. That's what Buck McKeon, he's the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee from California, where you are, Ian, who's basically said we need to keep the defense up there. It's a TARP program, you know, to create jobs. And that's where he is. And when push comes to shove, they will vote in favor of taxes in exchange for saving the military budget. And it'll keep us towards that path of ruination.
So I thought actually that was Ron Paul's best moment in that debate on national security, where everybody was basically saying the sky is falling with Obama, that he's threatening the security of this country and that we have to stand strong. There was absolute, with the exception of Ron Paul, they were all falling over backwards to support Israel, even in a war against Iran. But Ron Paul actually, in regard to the defense, cutting the defense budget, he said, oh, that's all nonsense. That, you know, that's just Washington talk. It'll never happen.
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. And I want to, if I could address just for a moment the issue of Iran, you know, the nuclear ambitions and all of that. There are a couple of observations to make. You know, Ron Paul, no one supports nuclear proliferation, but sometimes it happens. The question isn't, you know whether it's a good thing. Obviously, it's not. You know, I'm not flattered or eased when Pakistan or North Korea or others who haven't signed the nuclear non-proliferation treaty have nuclear weapons. But the fact is that we are creating an incentive for the Iranians to develop nuclear weapons because we have an official policy. It was enshrined by Newt Gingrich when he was in Congress to overthrow the regime. And they look around and see what happened to Gaddafi when he didn't have nukes. And so the incentive is to develop them to protect their own integrity as a nation. And Iranians, remember, our overthrow of Prime Minister Mossadegh, the only democratic elected prime minister in its history in 1953. The second thing is, you know, if Iran does acquire nuclear weapons, in my judgment, and I think Iran, it's insane to bomb them, to declare war. We don't do that with North Korea or Pakistan. We don't applaud it. But number one, it probably couldn't prevent a resurrection of nuclear weapons even after there were some efforts to strategically strike some of the nuclear plants. And moreover, deterrence works. We have the greatest nuclear arsenal in the history of the world. No one has ever attempted to try to attack, use nuclear weapons. We're the only ones who have ever used nuclear weapons. And if the Soviet Union was frightened at the nuclear threat of retaliation at the Cuban Missile Crisis, even though they had really thousands of nuclear warheads to throw back at us, is the idea that Iran could not be deterred from using nuclear weapons against us is utterly absurd. And it said, well, the Iranians, they crave self-destruction. They want to die as fast as possible, you know, in order to get to heaven. Well, you know, I've never heard anything so delusionary. I've never known any country that wanted to commit suicide. And if you look how Iran has, in fact, acted, even after the Islamic Revolution, you know, they had a negotiated treaty or end to the Iraq war. They negotiated with us and released our hostages held in the embassy. They negotiated payment when we shot down the USS Vincennes, shot down a civilian aircraft. They act cynically like all other powers, but they're certainly not, you know, bent on self-destruction. And this concoction, well, now for the first time in the history of the world, we have a country that wants to destroy itself. It shows you how far these people are willing to go in order to justify and prop up this empire.
Well, this is what's so extraordinary, though, about this phony debate on defense cuts and that the sky is falling because of the sequestration. I mean, first of all, the $400 billion that Panetta said he was going to take out of the defense budget, that's largely been taken out because of they're getting out of Iraq. So they want to win both ways. Bush didn't count the Iraq costs because they were off the budget. And now Obama's counting the Iraq costs and saying, oh, because we're pulling out of Iraq, we're saving all this money.
We're saving the money that we didn't spend, yeah. And then, we never appropriated, right?
Exactly. So the idea that they would cut, you know, some, what I don't know what the $600 billion more. The point, if this happens, and we both agreed that it was set up so that it won't happen after the election, that would still, if in other words, if the worst case scenario took place, we would still be back at 2007 budgetary levels.
And moreover, in comparison to the rest of the world, we'd still have the most staggeringly expensive and technologically advanced, you know, defense in the whole world. You know, we don't just build this for ornamentation. It's supposed to actually serve a real purpose, namely defending the United States in a way that makes sense. And then underscore, defending the United States, not the whole world. Now, why are we in Libya? We're going, maybe we're in Syria, and we're now fighting the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda. You know, anytime anything moves or creeps, we got a military response. You know, the United States has to get involved. Listen, the United States government has a duty and allegiance only to protect Americans and American people, not abroad. If individuals like you or me or your listeners want to volunteer and become Nobel Prize winners for XYZ and like Albert Schweitzer, that's the freedom that we enjoy. But the United States government has no authority and legitimacy in taking our tax money and our lives and our limbs and saying, we're going to make you be a good Samaritan abroad, even if you don't want to. That's individual choice, not the choice of the government.
Well, just in closing, Bruce Fine, since you're a senior advisor to Ron Paul's 2012 presidential campaign, and as I say, you get the impression that from the way the audience always cheers what he says, that there's a lot of support for him out there. Do you think that there is any way to get around the system, the media system that basically seems to favor this kind of conventional thinking? In the last couple of seconds,
we do well. We have the social media, and it's not like you know years ago, Ian. When I remember, and you probably remember, you had CBS, ABC, and NBC, and nothing else. So there certainly is an opportunity to bypass the major media and get a message through the internet. And the youth, especially, is very adept at on the internet, and perhaps the one most excited about the Ron Paul campaign because they don't have the vested economic and professional interest in maintaining the empire. And I think just as the media pronounced that Mr. Thomas Dewey had won the 1948 election, I think that they are clearly miscalculating the depth of Ron Paul's support.
And well, Bruce, I'm afraid.
If he's in denial.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Bruce Fine, a senior advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 presidential campaign. He's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as associate deputy attorney general in the Reagan administration and headed up the impeachment for Richard Nixon and President Clinton. He's the author of The American Empire Before the Fall. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Kevin Zeese, who's been active in third-party politics, served as Ralph Nader's press secretary and spokesman in 2004. He's recently been active with the Occupy DC movement. He gave us an overview of where the Occupy movement is heading away from electoral politics. He's very, very angry at what he perceives as Democratic Party attempts to try and co-opt the movement, and he feels that eventually there is nothing to be gained from electoral politics, that even though the both the Democrats and the Republicans are held in lowest esteem imaginable, it's still not possible to get a third-party candidate going, that essentially what's going to have to happen to this country is a revolution, starting with the 99% movement, galvanizing around issues of who really controls the country and taking back control from the oligarchs by simply old-fashioned activism. And he feels that Occupy movements are leading the way. Then I spoke with Jacob Halbrun, who wrote the book They Knew They Were Right, The Rise of the Neocons, about how the latest Republican presidential candidates debate on national security. The question is, were all of the neocons responsible for the last decade's disastrous wars and deficits? There they were, you know, asking the questions. Of course, it was hosted by the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation. So that's not entirely surprising that that should be the situation. But it perhaps indicates the possibility of these totally discredited neocons coming back, since all the candidates except for Huntsman and Ron Paul are pro-empire and more war, more war, more war. Then finally, I spoke with Bruce Fine. He's a senior advisor to Ron Paul's 2012 presidential campaign, and he really did explain Ron Paul's foreign policy. Also made it clear that, you know, Ron Paul is actually quite popular. And all of his positions are very popular with the American people. But the country is still pretty much in the grip of the military-industrial complex and a political class that supports American empire. He didn't share Kevin Zeese's kind of revolutionary prescription, but did say that eventually through alternative media that Ron Paul's message against empire and defending America and not the American empire will eventually resonate. And he, in a curious way, it was sort of reminiscent of a lot of progressive arguments about how the only way to get the message out is through alternative media, since it's pretty clear that if you look at the Republican candidates on stage with Ron Paul, they all treat him with kind of scorn and derision, and of course, the media completely ignore him. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. And you can't see.